update your home and save big money with Mastercraft Doors at Menards. For over 50 years, Mastercraft has been making quality doors inside and out. Choose from the best in-stock selection of interior and exterior doors ready to take home today. Or design your door your way with our free designer in-store or on Menards.com. Save big on Mastercraft Doors and check out more great deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So let's talk about Kathleen Lamborn, our victim in this case. She was born in Brisbane, in Queensland, in 1946. Gorgeous area of the world, goes without saying. She graduated in 1968 with a bachelor's degree in veterinary science with honours from the University of Queensland, so she's super smart. We all know how clever and competent and realistically academic you have to be to become a vet. When people describe Kathleen, I think there's quite a mixed bag opinion-wise about who this lady was, but she was described as being somebody who was very strong-willed and very outspoken. And I think that that can have a really good and, to some degree, bad connotations, because some of us really like those go-getters who just say it as it is and aren't afraid to speak their truth. But sometimes that can be quite bombastic and overpowering. And if you are somebody who believes that you were born to lead and you take on that role and you do it in a way that you feel is appropriate without seeing that sometimes that bulldozes other less out there personalities, it can cause a little bit of resentment from time to time. And she has this dominant personality that people have a Marmite relationship and reaction to. It's either you love her or you hate her. Actually, I said Marmite, which is a spread that we use in the UK. It's yeast-based. People genuinely do love or hate it. I love it. But I suppose in Australia, as it's an Australian case, we'd say Vegemite. You either love it or hate it. I bet every Australian who's watching it right now is like, Vegemite, we love it. She was somebody who had been married. That's where she changed her name to Kathleen Marshall. And people said that as a person, she was one of those people that was very passionate about particular things. And when she was passionate, she threw herself into things fully. And understandably, she clearly cares about animals because she was a vet, but she took it further. She was really passionate about animal rights, also about the environment. So she was somebody that is really an advocate for things that we hear about now, but less so back in the early 90s and 80s. People weren't necessarily talking about the environment and animal rights in the way that they do today. Certainly, I'm a massive animal rights advocate, so I would have been totally on board with her points of view. So she's clearly somebody who practices what she preaches. She's somebody who rescues animals and really does put her beliefs in obvious sight. And aside from the animals, she very much was the environmentalist. And where her house was situated probably gave her a great sense of joy because she was very much an environmentalist. And literally over her garden fence, there was the bushland of Eildon Hill Reservoir Reserve. She also was said to grow lots of trees and shrubs in the front garden. So there was this really thick foliage around her house and practice. And even though on one level that sounds kind of nice, the idea of this house surrounded in foliage, I think as well it can sometimes appear quite unkempt. And maybe she has more of an interest.
Ultimately,
in,
her marriage failed.
Her garden and
actual animals
than she does.
And
in
she ends up having
her business
and
her home
in the same
negative
place. Essentially,
her,
believe me,
she has a house above her veterinary clinic in Wilston.
Just saying,
and this is where she's got eight cats.
I think part of her personality
was very much
dogs,
about her passion,
which she'd rescued.
She was less concerned about stuff looking good. Now, some years after she separates from her husband, she does end up spending some time with a man called Ian Galton. He was a solicitor. He was kind of on and off in her life for a while. He lived with her at times and then moved out. She was said to be this very, very social person. And of course, because you're a vet, it means you're going to have access to lots of people around you. People are going to know you. You're also going to be one of the people who's considered a staple in your community. The closer you are as well to people like vets and doctors.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The easier it is to access certain help and tips at times when you might require them. So I imagine that she was quite popular to some degree. She apparently knew a lot of the local people on a name basis. So aside from being known because of her veterinary work, I think she also enjoyed being seen as somebody who was quite prominent in the local community. So she became a member of Queensland's Cat Protection Society. And understandably, that's all about rightfully protecting the welfare of cats, because cats are iconic. And then we get to 1996, and she actually became the chairperson of the organisation. She also, around this time, created a singles social group called L'Epicure, which was based on gourmet dining. And let me tell you, Kathleen had some rules. I mean, we all need rules, don't we? That's why I do this on this channel, because people will break those rules called laws, and there are consequences. We all like a few boundaries. We all like to know what's appropriate and inappropriate. But I think Kathleen was a little bit overboard. So for example, when she's creating this L'Epicure, which is all about this gourmet fine dining, she wants a particular standard, shall we say, of individual who joins. And if you wanted to become part of the group, firstly, it was for people who were professional. Also, they had to be over the age of 35. They had to be really well educated. And the women, they needed to be super well educated. I can't quite imagine whether somebody was with her when she was putting together the requirements for this. But it would have been quite an odd scenario. Like, Kathleen, what are you doing? I'm just putting some requirements down for a elite dining club. It's a singles club, to be honest, but it involves gourmet dining. Wow. That sounds really good. I'm single. I would really like to be involved. Could I join? I don't know. It's for very bright people. I'm bright. I'm bright. We've been friends for years. You know I'm bright. Yeah. You are bright. So can I join? I'm just going to check my criteria. Have you got a degree? Yes, I've got a degree. Have you? Yeah, I've got a degree. Have you got two? No, Kathleen, I've not got two. Oh dear. Sorry, it's just that you have to have two. Really? Because I feel like you've just made that up so that I definitely can't join your gourmet singles group. Just two. Just, you can. Just go and do another degree. Anyway, the women needed to have at least 2 degrees, but the men, not so much. They just needed one university degree. And if you think statistically about how many people have got one degree versus those who've got 2 degrees, I mean, she was pretty much ensuring that, you know, it was easy for guys to make the grade. I have no idea why Kathleen appears to be such a misogynist at this point. I'm not trying to be nasty to her. I'm just saying. Maybe she'd had some bad experiences with relationships and she was like, I really need to vet these people. Ooh, vet these people. A vet was vetting these people, but I really need to vet these people diligently and make sure that these women have to aspire to certain things that I believe make them not likely to run off with the guy that I like. It could have been that. I don't know, but I'm unsure as to why there is blatant sexism in the entry requirements of a group made by a woman. But it goes ahead and the group would meet for meals roughly 2 times each month. Maybe there was, I don't know, 40 men and 3 women. We're just like, we're so qualified. We're so we're popular as well. Look how popular we are. But anyway, this is what happens. So she's very avid in the socializing and she's somebody who clearly enjoys to be the center of attention to some degree. And it's on one of these gourmet meal get-togethers that Kathleen's absence is actually first noticed. So it's on February the 27th, 1998. She's meant to be attending a meal with the Lepicur group, but she just doesn't turn up to this. And that is very, very strange. First of all, she'd actually been the one to arrange the get-together, so that's completely out of character. She's very diligent in attending, and also she enjoys it. She hadn't called anybody to let them know, and other members felt that it was really unusual. So they tried to contact her. Some of them had tried contacting her beforehand and they hadn't been able to get through to her. And one of the members had left voicemails that had never been returned. So they all found that it was strange. But even though everybody found it was a little bit odd, no one went to check on her. Maybe they were thinking about some kind of gourmet meal coup, where they could all just spend a bit of time without Kathleen deciding whether they can make the rules a little bit easier so that local single women might be able to attend and it isn't just her and a few others who managed to make the grade. I'm just throwing that in there, I don't know it. But anyway, they didn't go and check on her. But that's not unusual. A lot of us will have been in situations and circumstances where somebody doesn't turn up for something. We don't immediately think that something terrible has happened. We get to March the 1st, 1998. So obviously time has passed now. Again, she's actually set to attend a meeting with the Cat Protection Society at Wilston State School. Now, bear in mind, she's very dedicated to this. She's devoted, essentially, to the cat protection organisation that she's working with. And the aim of this particular meeting is pretty important. It's to resolve some disputes between members of the organisation. And she's meant to be there. Of course she is. She's the individual who's organising the thing and is in charge. So she should be present. She doesn't turn up. Now, at that point, the members are really concerned because this is not Kathleen's MO at all. She would be present. So they end up deciding that they'll go around to her house. So 4 members of the club go around to her house around 2:30 p.m. after they've had the meeting. When they arrive, the first thing they notice is that the door to her veterinary clinic is actually locked. But then the second thing that essentially hits them is this awful odour. Also, they notice there are lots of flies around. They can also see blood, as far as they're concerned, on the outside of the door and also more on the floor inside when they look through the window. They then call the police, who find, unfortunately, when they enter, that Kathleen is deceased. She's lay face down on the floor of her veterinary clinic. And when they look at her body, they feel that she has been stabbed multiple times. It's clear to them that that's at least how it seems she's died. And as expected, you would imagine there will be a lot of blood loss when somebody has met their death in such a brutal way, because when somebody's been stabbed multiple times, they've literally been butchered. And there was blood everywhere. It was on the outside of the door. It was on the doormat. There was also blood splatter on the plants by the door. Kathleen's clothes were literally soaked in blood and there were pools of blood around her body. Also, there was blood in the sink. So it seems like someone had made a really poor attempt at trying to clean up. When it came down to the autopsy, it later showed that she'd been stabbed 52 times. But the autopsy also revealed that the wounds were quite shallow. So we wouldn't imagine, for example, a man striking a woman with a knife in a way that was relatively shallow. It's probably more in keeping with what we'd expect for a female when it comes down to stabbing. Her injuries were actually located on her head, her face, her arms, her chest and her abdomen. And also the wounds to her chest, they were made in an upwards and backwards motion.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
There are also indications that there'd been a struggle. So one of the windows had been broken. And also it seemed that Kathleen had tried to defend herself because she'd got cuts on her hands. She'd also put her three dogs out on the back veranda. Now, when you think about why somebody would do that, well, ultimately you would imagine they did it because she was expecting somebody. So she either thought that the dogs might make a racket, or maybe the dogs are a bit problematic around certain people. Maybe it's a person that she's expecting but doesn't have a familiarity with, therefore she doesn't want the dogs having any kind of issue around them, and so she puts them out on the veranda. So essentially they're thinking, well, is it somebody that she's known, or is it somebody that's new to this situation that could potentially be the reason why she's met her death? The police do a search all around the nearby area, and it's found that there's blood near a postbox. And actually, when they look inside, they discovered clothing, and that clothing was literally covered in blood. Now, those items of clothing, they included a pair of shoes, they included gloves, they also found blood leading up to a broken shop window and also a payphone. So clearly, at this moment in time, they think, wow, this is a real coup. We're likely going to have the killer because they've dumped the clothes here, and now we're going to have their DNA all over them. So the police then do an investigation on the calls made from the phone, and it was actually found that an ambulance had been called for a man who had a really deep cut to his leg. So again, this feels like a really promising lead. Officers then went to Royal Brisbane Hospital and spoke to the man who'd made that call. Now, it turns out it wasn't him, but he did end up getting charged with a crime that was unrelated to Kathleen's murder. So they didn't get the guy for that crime, but they did get the guy for another crime. When they're searching Kathleen's house, one of the things that really draws their attention is the fact that it just is extremely messy and disheveled. And they just think that somebody has come in, gone on a rampage after killing her, made a state of the place. But then when they take a step back, they realised that Kathleen had just lived an untidy life to some degree. And I guess she has a lot of animals. Her priorities are in different places and spaces. And some people like to keep a tidy home. And some people are just quite happy to live in, shall we say, a very comfortable, stroke messy situation. And Kathleen's one of those. A police officer did notice, however, that sheet music on her antique piano had been turned to valse, and in brackets, posthumous. And he at this point wondered if the killer had turned it to that page specifically, believing it to be a death march. Now, that's what the research says. I don't want to question this too much, guys. I really don't. But I did present a classical music show for a big radio station in the UK, and valse actually means waltz. And also posthumously just means that the music was actually released after the composer's death. So I don't know why he drew that conclusion, but I feel like that officer was probably reading a little bit too much into it. I don't think that some murderer had come in and gone, oh my goodness, how fortunate. There is a piano with music. I shall spend some time just scanning through the music to find an appropriate particular tune that people can walk into and realise I placed, so that you can all feel that I'm even more sinister. A musical signature of such. I don't think that's the case. I just don't think that the officer knew a lot about this area of the world of classical music. But I do connect with why, when you have posthumous, you know, it notes death, doesn't it? But like I said, it's not actually a death march, as far as I'm concerned anyway. They also find Kathleen's diary, which is really important. Of course it is, because it means that you can track where somebody's meant to be, where they have been, and kind of figure out who they were with last. And it contains her appointments, of course. And she'd actually had an appointment at 12:30 p.m. and another at 1 p.m. And they then went ahead and spoke to the man who'd come in at 12:30 p.m. with his dog. He said he remembered an old couple arriving as he was leaving, and that person recollected perfectly because the two people who were arriving were Kathleen's friends, Lichiades, and they actually also had a memory of seeing somebody else arrive after they did, which was a man who arrived with a Siamese cat. Now, that would have been her 1 o'clock appointment, so they leave upon his arrival, having absolutely no idea that that would be the last time that they'd ever see their friend Kathleen again. Now, the man who was named in the diary, the man who turned up with that Siamese cat, he was written into her diary as John Wilson, but police genuinely couldn't locate him. So at that point, they suspected that it was very likely somebody had used a fake name. And again, that's very suspicious, particularly when you've got a dead body that you're dealing with. Now, when it came down to the search for people who could be linked to her death, they had to look at people who could potentially have a motive. And it is quite difficult when you think about who she is as a human being. It's not as if she's in gangs, she's not criminal, she's not even in a relationship that's deeply problematic. So it's quite challenging to see why this single woman who's a cat rescuer, who's very embedded in her community, would end up dying such a brutal death. So they have to think about everybody being a potential suspect. And during the inquiries, it comes to light that she had had considerable conflicts with certain people. So in particular, members of the Cat Protection Society, which Kathleen was the president of, she had struggles. So the society received quite a lot of money in donations. We know that when you're a charity, some people are very kind and they leave you certain amounts of money, particularly if they are passionate about the subject area that you're engaged with and organising for. So in this case, cats. Who doesn't love cats? Of course people are going to give money to great charities that support cats. So they're getting donations, also people leave money in their wills, and apparently the way that the money was being spent was causing quite a lot of arguments amongst the members. And we all understand the reason in the Bible. There's quite a lot of references to money being the root of all evil. It's because money does make people do a lot of really nasty things. And if you've got control over money, sometimes it can make you feel a little bit powerful. And if you don't have control over the money and you think somebody else has it and you want it, and so on and so forth, these are genuinely psychological realities. We all know it. We've all been in situations and experienced it. It can make people that we think are lovely turn quite insidious and nasty at times. So there's a lot of infighting. And interestingly, stroke bizarrely, stroke terrifyingly, there'd actually been another murder of a Cat Protection Society member in the not too distant past. So in 1982, Frank Castagnola had been shot outside his house. Now, the murder was never solved, but he had recently changed his will prior to his death so that his estate was left to the Cat Protection Society, which is pretty scary, isn't it? It's one of those strange scenarios that you change your will and then suddenly you end up dead. And so at the time of Kathleen's death, it was said that the group was basically very divided. People either sided with Kathleen or sided with another woman called Virginia Houston. Now, Houston had been a director of the society, but she'd basically been fired and she was devastated. She loved the Cat Protection Society. She'd also been one of its treasurers. So Kathleen and Houston were basically involved in this really bitter dispute over the funds. And in one incident, Houston tried to force her way into Kathleen's home, which basically resulted in a scuffle. And these aren't young, these aren't teenagers. These aren't young children. These are grown-ups. These are, you know, adults. Professionals. They're having a scuffle on the veranda, pushing, shoving. I imagine there was some hair pulling. It's just one of those things that you see a lot when women fight. Houston actually had said at this point that she felt when the police arrived, because Kathleen called the police, because this was falling into a scenario that she didn't want to have to manage, and she didn't feel that she should have to manage because this woman had come to her home. when the police arrived, Houston was very defensive and was like, I can be here. I can be in Kathleen's home. It's the registered address of the society. So I want to be here because I'm a part of that society. So that's why Kathleen felt entitled to turn up, just because that was the registered address of the society. And even though I totally understand where this particular individual is coming from, it's not okay to turn up at somebody's address and then essentially assault them. It's not okay. Particularly when you're the person who's ended up at that place of residence. Now, that incident had occurred only 6 weeks before Kathleen was killed. And again, we could say that's kind of a high-level incident, isn't it? Where somebody gets violent and somebody feels that compelled to turn up at your own home to take you on. Now, some of Kathleen's friends immediately believed that Houston was the person responsible for her death, even referred to her as the murderer in front of the police. So she becomes a murder suspect in the case pretty immediately. And they think, well, she had motive. Also, because the nature of the attack was so brutal, it indicates that it was potentially a crime of passion. So it would be somebody that she had some kind of relationship with. When we see situations of overkill where somebody's repeatedly stabbed, often, not always, but often, it is somebody that has very strong feelings towards and about that person. And Veronica Houston certainly was passionate about the Cat Protection Society. So the police end up interviewing her, and she basically said, yeah, I really did have some animosity between myself and Kathleen. I don't like the way that she behaves. I don't like the way that she treats people. I don't know, by the way, whether it was Kathleen or Veronica who actually threw the first punch. Maybe the reason that Veronica Houston didn't like Kathleen was because it was Kathleen who punched her first. Who knows? But she certainly didn't like the way that Kathleen treated people. But she vehemently denied that she had any involvement in the murder. And nothing of note was found in the search of her house. Nothing of note was found in the search of her car. And she also had an alibi covering part of the time of interest for the murder. So the police are feeling relatively frustrated because they want to find the person who's carried out this heinous crime, but they're not necessarily getting there fast. We get to April 1998, and at this point, it was revealed that there were drops of male blood present. So of course, even though Houston is pretty much in the line of fire as far as the police are concerned, despite the fact that she's got partly an alibi for some of the time, and she's obviously resisting acknowledging or admitting that she's had anything to do with the crime whatsoever, when they get this male DNA, understandably, it makes them think that she is going to be less prominent as a suspect in this case. So investigators then start asking a lot of the men who knew Kathleen to just provide blood samples because they want to rule these individuals out. So they end up taking samples from 42 people, but none of them were a match. So then the police move on to people who knew Houston, including one of her ex-boyfriends. He actually refused to provide a blood sample. And this kind of sounds a little bit suspicious when you listen to it cold, because first of all, he says, no, I'm not providing you with a blood sample. Then he literally leaves the boarding house where he'd been staying. And he also buys a ticket to Sydney under an alias. Now, if you are a copper, you're like, wait a minute. Not only has he said no to the DNA sample, he's literally left where he lives and bought a ticket with a false name. He sounds like totally innocent. We should definitely exclude him from all of our inquiries.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
So who would do this apart from an innocent person? So understandably, he's a massive suspect. But then when they get him in for interview, he agreed to provide a DNA sample and it wasn't a match to the blood that had been found at the crime scene. And I always have that feeling that for some people, particularly if they've got a history with the police, maybe they've served time, they may have a very bad taste in their mouth about how they've been treated. They may sometimes feel that the police don't operate in a truthful and honest way. And they may think, oh, I was in a relationship with her at some point, they're going to fit me up for the crime. So that could be the anxiety as to why he left, but they do rule him out. Now, among the people who were associates of Houston was 49-year-old Andrew Fitzherbert. Now, this guy is a palm reader and also a member of the Spiritualist Church, but I can tell you now, I don't think that he could see what was coming. He's going to throw it out there. I just think that palm readers tend to be able to forecast what's going to happen. And I genuinely don't think that Andrew Fitzherbert could have predicted exactly what's going to play out in his life. So his partner, Ruth Bennett, she was a member of the Cat Protection Society and she was also a friend of Houston. And he himself had also recently applied to be a member as well, but he'd been rejected. Of course he'd been rejected because Kathleen, we know, has very strict rules and criteria as to who is allowed into the Cats Protection Organisation. I do think it's a bit strange, guys, that Kathleen rejected somebody from this organisation. At the end of the day, isn't it about protecting cats? I mean, it's not like an empire, is it? You're there to protect cats. Cats are your main interest. What was Kathleen doing when it came down to these strict criteria, you know? So you want to... You want to join this Cats Protection Society? Yes. Why? Well, I really like cats. That's actually not one of the, it's not one of the criteria that you need to meet. Okay. I'm very organized. Again, not interested. I am somebody who's quite social, good for helping raise funds. Totally disinterested in that. Could you just tell me what the criteria is for getting into the Cats Protection Organisation that I want to apply for, because I'm really invested in protecting animals? Do you have 3 degrees and a doctorate? No. Well, I'm afraid you failed point C. What was point A? You have to speak 3 languages. I'm not poking fun at the victim here. I'm just saying that sometimes when you are in a position where you've got a little bit of power, sometimes you can forget that other people have the same interests as you and the same beliefs and the same passions, and you should use your power in a positive way because it can really create animosity in relationships. And I think that that was certainly happening where Kathleen is concerned. So the police at this point find out that he's been rejected, and that maybe that could be something that would upset him. And they're also made at this point aware that he owns a Siamese cat. Also a Siamese cat that apparently matched the description of the cat that John Wilson, who was meant to be the person who Kathleen had seen before her death, had been carrying. Again, I am not going to deride this investigation or these witnesses. I'm just saying, look, this is Chase. Chase is the most beautiful chocolate Abyssinian cat, right? I would like to think that in a room full of 1,000 chocolate Abyssinian cats, I would be able to pick Chase out. But there's a really strong possibility, unless he ran over to me and started doing this, that I wouldn't. Because cats can, and some of you are going to be screaming at me, you'll be screaming at the screen saying, I would know my cat anywhere.
And some of you would. I'm just saying that when it comes down to things like Abyssinians and Siamese, a lot of them look the same. A lot of them look the same. So the fact that John Wilson, the guy who apparently has seen Kathleen before her death, was carrying a Siamese cat, I don't necessarily think that the witnesses would have been paying that much attention to the cat. I imagine you'd probably more be focused on the actual person carrying the cat. How much time were they spending noting what the cat looked like? I mean, it's Siamese, that's it. So they learned this information in June 1998 because Ruth Bennett had been featured in the Courier Mail. And the article included a picture of Ruth holding a Siamese cat. They showed a selection of photographs with one of these photos being of Fitzherbert to the Lichiades, who'd actually witnessed the man with the cat at Kathleen's clinic. And they basically identified the picture of Fitzherbert as looking similar to the man they'd seen that day. They may well have. Personally, I will say this again, it's very difficult often to remember the features of somebody that you passed, unless there is something incredibly notable about them. And in this case, it wouldn't have been entirely notable because this was somebody who had an appointment with Kathleen that she was expecting with a cat because she was a vet. So unless there is something quite outlandish about this individual, you can't help but think you might not get it right when it comes down to appropriately identifying somebody. It was also found that a phone call had been made from Fitzherbert and Ruth's home to Kathleen 2 days before she died. That, of course, means that maybe they could have arranged the vet appointment for the cat. So he could have indeed done that as well. I'm not saying this didn't happen. I'm saying it's worth looking at every different vantage point. Also, there had been at least 4 phone calls made from the Spiritualist Church to Kathleen on the 25th of February. And it did seem that Fitzherbert had only been the person there at the time that the phone calls were made. So again, that links him to Kathleen. Arguably though, if he's been rejected by Kathleen from something he wants to join, he may be ringing her to find out why. Now, when investigators speak to him, he says, "I've never spoken to Kathleen on the phone." He also said he didn't know where she lived. He also said that he had never met her before, which is gonna sound really suspicious when you think about the information that I've just given you. But investigators become even more suspicious of Fitzherbert because when they ask him to provide a voluntary blood sample, he says no. Then when they bring him into the police station to actually interview him, he doesn't drink anything, he doesn't go to the toilet whilst he's there, and it's probably because he's forensically aware, or at least they will believe that, not wanting to leave his DNA behind. But investigators really want to test his blood. Now, they do actually make an application to see whether they can forcibly take him to a hospital to take the blood, and to do that they need to obviously apply to the courts, but the courts deny it. And it turned out the court said the only way that you can get that particular sample is if he's arrested for this, and then you can make that mandatory, and there wasn't enough evidence at this point for an arrest. So they serve a warrant to search his home. During the search, they actually managed to take a handkerchief, and he'd blown his nose into the handkerchief, meaning that with all his DNA on the handkerchief, and that meant they could test this handkerchief, and they found it matched the blood at the crime scene. So for a lot of us, it's case closed, he's banged to rights, his DNA is there, he said he's never been there, he said he's never met with Kathleen, he's never spoken to Kathleen, so by his own denying of any connection, arguably, he's placed himself as the obvious suspect now, the obvious predator, the killer. Because how would his DNA be in her home unless he'd been there? Now, almost 5 months after Kathleen's death, Fitzherbert's charged with a murder. Now, let me tell you, this wasn't just surprising to Fitzherbert, the palm reader. It was also incredibly surprising to everybody who knew him. And I mean everybody. He's really mild-mannered. He was apparently a pacifist. He had no criminal record. He was also frail. He was described as looking quite weak. But then you can see immediately the prosecution thinking to themselves, right, and that's why the stab wounds on Kathleen's body had been so shallow. But at the same time, one could argue, well, Kathleen Colleen can pack a punch. You know, she had an altercation when Veronica came round. So she likely, if this guy is weak and frail and physically unwell, she might well have been able to dominate him if he'd been trying to stab her. So that's almost a contradiction when it comes down to the reality. So the trial takes place in July of 1999 and Fitzherbert pleads not guilty. Now, one of the problems during the court proceedings, and it is a big problem, is there's dispute over Kathleen's time of death. So it was estimated by Russell Luke, who's an entomologist, that Kathleen's death had taken place between 9 p.m. on February the 26th, which was a Thursday, and 3 a.m. on February the 27th, which was the early hours of Friday morning. Her body hadn't actually been discovered until Sunday the 1st of March at around 2:30 p.m. Now, the estimate was reached by the analysis of maggots found on Kathleen's body. Kathleen hadn't answered calls or responded to voicemails that had been left for her from 6 p.m. on the Thursday. However, six witnesses, which is a hell of a lot of witnesses, they actually said, no, we saw Kathleen on the morning and afternoon of Friday, February the 27th. Three people did hear a scream near Kathleen's home around 6 p.m. on the Friday. And bear in mind, she had plans for dinner at 7:30 p.m. on the Friday that she didn't attend. So it's likely that she had actually been killed by then. So the prosecution questioned Luke, asking basically whether his estimate for Kathleen's time of death was based on the light in a clinic not being turned on, which he said, yeah, it was confirmed on the light being off. But again, witnesses said that they'd seen the clinic light had been on. And this is massively significant, guys, because flies do not lay their eggs in the dark. So Luke had taken that into account when calculating the time of death, which would mean that if the light had actually been on, as witnesses said it was, his calculations would be wrong. In addition to this, he'd also taken the temperature into account when reaching the estimate. And bear in mind, if the light was on, it would have increased the temperature. So that means that he would have completely, inaccurately decided when the death had occurred. Now, during the trial, Luke extended the likely time of death from 9 p.m. on Thursday the 26th to 3 p.m. on Friday the 27th. However, if the witnesses are to be believed, and why would the witnesses be lying? They want to know who did it just as much as anybody else. Then it's possible that Kathleen had actually been killed later than 3 p.m. on the Friday, so between then and around 7 p.m. The witnesses also who claimed that they'd seen Kathleen alive on the Friday included people that she really knew. So Gertrude Gwynn, Kathleen's next-door neighbour, she'd seen her specifically around 10 a.m. in the morning. She'd actually had a conversation with Gertrude. She said that she was going to go to the pharmacy because she wasn't feeling well. David Kelly, the pharmacist, he saw her just after 10 a.m. and again at 4 p.m. Then we've got Kathleen Stevenson, who'd only known her for just, 30 years. She'd seen Kathleen getting out of a car and actually walking to the newsagents at 10:15 a.m. She even said that she'd been wearing a white waisted dress with a very thin blue pinstripe, and that was an accurate description of the clothes Kathleen had been wearing when she was killed. Is it just me, guys? Or can we all agree at this moment in time that the witnesses saw Kathleen alive at the time that apparently Kathleen's dead, according to a guy who doesn't actually know Kathleen's, never met Kathleen, and estimated her death inaccurately based on the fact that the lights were going to be off in the clinic, even though the witnesses said the lights were on. Just throwing it out there at this point. I'm not finished. Greg Rowe, Kathleen's neighbour, he saw Kathleen driving at 2:15 and again at 2:45 p.m. In the first sighting, he said that she had a male passenger with her, but then in the second sighting, apparently she was returning home alone. Then we've got Jessica Dawson. She knew her. She worked at the newsagent. She said Kathleen had been in the shop just after 10 a.m. And again, it's all in line with what she was saying. She was going to the pharmacy. She was probably going to go and run some errands. And that she'd also return later that afternoon, sometime between 3 and 4 p.m. Then there's Warren Smith, another one of Kathleen's neighbours. They saw her leave in the newsagents and was actually in the car behind her at around 10:15 a.m. He also spotted her another two times, firstly around 4:35 p.m. in the newsagents, then again at 4:45 p.m. when she drove past him in the car. And Warren had also heard that distinctive sound of her front door at 6 p.m. and again at 8 p.m. And Warren had also added to his witness testimony that he'd heard her door at 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. apparently had a very distinctive sound when it opened and closed. Now, all of those accounts, all of them state that Kathleen was alive and well on Friday, at least until 4:45 p.m., which had been the very last sighting of her. So who are we to believe? A guy who's just estimating when she died, probably on false information that he's just created without actually having knowledge, or the people who literally live next door to her? Also, you want to go on a neighborhood watch scheme in places like that, because they notice a lot.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Oh, I like it when there are active neighbors, you know? We call them curtain switches in the UK, where people just like look out whenever they hear a noise. But those kind of people, they save you in certain situations, don't they? Because they notice when things happen. And in this situation, it didn't save Kathleen's life, but certainly it meant that they were very astute when coming down to the details of when they believe she died. But apparently the prosecution aren't going to buy into any of that. So when it comes down to the actual evidence that's presented to the court against Fitzherbert, it's about 5 drops of blood that they found at the scene. These 5 drops of blood that apparently matched his DNA. Now, bear in mind, most of the drops had been under the broken window in the clinic, but apparently one had been by the sink and it had been mixed with Kathleen's blood, which indicated that they'd bled at the same time. So it was said by the expert in this case that the likelihood of the blood belonging to anyone other than Fitzherbert was 14 to 10 to the power of 15 to 1. That means it would be 14 quadrillion to one. And yes, I had to literally call my nephew-in-law, who's a maths teacher, because I didn't know how big that number was. I appreciated it was big, but just let that run through your mind again. So the evidence that they're saying in this state is that the chances of it not being the person we're talking about is 14 quadrillion to one. Now, if you're a jury member and you're hearing that, I don't know, you're going to be a bit convinced about that number, aren't you? Because there's only about 7 billion people in the world, and you'll be like, whoa, there's only 7 billion people in the world, then it's definitely this guy whose DNA is there. Because there's a whole heap of notes that I've never seen before in the number that I've just given you. You're going to be convinced it's got to be him. Now, it was a guy called Ken Cox, the forensic biologist from the John Tong Center, who was the expert who told the jury that there was that one chance in 14 trillion the blood found at the crime scene was from someone other than Fitzherbert. That is going to be impressive and persuasive. Like I said, the population on Earth is just like 7 billion. So that would make it feel like that is such an accurate reality. It must be that you're only ever going to match 1 in 14 trillion people. There'll only be somebody else like you that rarely. But that's not how it works. And actually, the calculated frequency is just an estimate. And apparently, back then, it was often off in a magnitude in either direction. Also, Cox didn't tell the court that they'd had some problems at John Tong Centre. They hadn't even obtained accreditation by the National Association of Testing Authorities at the time that he was testing the DNA. And they'd had problems at that centre because when they'd been investigated, they'd discovered shortcomings such as poorly documented records, unsealed evidence, unrestricted access to specimens, and potentially contaminated specimens in the refrigerator. So by the time of the trial, yes, the centre had managed to get the accreditation, but the point was it hadn't at the time of original testing, so he shouldn't have been in court talking about it. But of course, when he's in court at the trial, he is saying, well, we're accredited, etc. He's making a point of mentioning it. Doesn't mention all those shortcomings I've just talked about that Natta had found the previous year. which is deceptive as far as I'm concerned. Also, and this might blow your mind a little bit, there were 25 blood samples collected from the crime scene, and all of those were assumed to be the victim because it was a female's blood, essentially. But what if the murderer was a woman? What if the 25 blood samples indicated another female had been present? And also, other crucial evidence wasn't even tested. So there was a pair of bloodied shoes, and apparently it was unlikely that they belonged to Kathleen. It wasn't her style. When they found her body, one of the things that they noticed was that her feet were actually clean without bloodstains. But nobody bothered to actually check that the shoes were her size or fit. There was just an assumption that they must be. Also, Fitzherbert did provide, I don't know, just what you'd expect would be a big reason not to be in court. Alibis for the Thursday and Friday. So he and Ruth ate dinner together on the Thursday night, and then one of their friends came over to their house to use their printer. They went to bed around 10:30 p.m. Then on Friday, he and Ruth had been shopping during the day, returning home at 3:30 p.m. as confirmed by Ruth's son, Tim. Then they'd gone out again around 6:15 p.m. because they were attending a meditation evening. Then they'd arrived there about 7:15 p.m. with the journey taking about an hour. They're pretty strong alibis. Just throwing it out there. Now, despite having alibis, because they were only supported apparently by family members, they were basically thrown out to some degree. This prosecution alleged that it was a concoction of lies that they'd all cooked up. Just going to throw it out there. Not quite convinced those at the meditation evening an hour away were like calling on it, you know? You're just sitting there like totally zen. It's having a really nice, really, really nice meditation evening. Yeah, really enjoying it. Yeah? I'm gonna need a favor. What favor? I need you to just say that I was here or when I wasn't here. Okay, that doesn't feel like it's there and it doesn't feel like in keeping with my whole vibe. So I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do that. Listen, I've murdered somebody. You're just going to have to say I was here. The police are going to come calling, okay? And you need to let everybody else in the meditation group know, right? That's all I'm saying. Just do it. Don't ask any questions. Okay. Peace and love. Be safe. You know what I mean? There was a meditation group. Why is that not? What happens in situations where alibis are considered? What if you are with your family? That is a true alibi. What if you were in a meditation group? That's a true alibi. How does that get thrown out? Apparently, that's the case. Even though they were at a meditation evening, that doesn't count. And the prosecution based everything on the early estimate of Kathleen's death as being correct. So they believed that she died at a time where witnesses said it wasn't possible, so they rely on that. And then, of course, that DNA is the thing that is really, really standing out. Those individuals on the jury have heard it's impossible it couldn't be him by this apparent expert on top of the other individuals saying the time of death could corroborate all of these things. And in spite of the fact that they hadn't tested lots of other things that could have led to a different perpetrator being caught for this case, it all comes down to this circumstantial evidence that sounds unbelievably powerful. Unbelievably powerful. Because when it comes down to it, the witnesses, who were many, they made it clear that the death, as far as they were concerned, must have occurred way later than the prosecution alleged. That would have meant that Fitzherbert was pretty much impossible to have been the killer. But because the prosecution keep laboring this point that it's absolutely got to be Fitzherbert, it's his DNA, who else could it be? It's a very convincing scenario. And in spite of everything I've said, in spite of all those witnesses, in spite of them likely getting the time of death wrong, when it comes down to the verdict, Fitzherbert's found guilty. Apparently, visually, physically, he was just absolutely devastated upon hearing the verdict because he still is saying, I have nothing to do with this. I am not guilty. We get to August 1999. This is when the sentencing occurs and he got life in prison. Judge McKenzie said, This was a crime of which you would not have been convicted, except for the recent explosion in advances in genetics. It was reported that in Australia, Fitzherbert was the first to be convicted of a crime only because of DNA evidence. Let's just forget the other massive amount of samples that they could have tested but didn't. Let's just forget that, because women don't kill anyone. No one's ever killed anyone whose females don't kill. No females ever killed anyone, ever. But that's what happened. Fitzherbert's lawyers were also devastated. They said that the jury had basically been dazzled by the numbers referring to the DNA and the likelihood that some of the blood had belonged to him. They said that it was just too overwhelming. As far as the jury were concerned, they couldn't not convict him. And even though they'd provided alibis, even though it was clear he was an unlikely suspect when you looked at his profile, they just were stuck on that DNA evidence. Now, in a later interview, Fitzherbert was actually told that he wouldn't have been found guilty if he'd said that he'd visited Dr. Marshall with his cat in the days before her death. So if he'd actually said, no, yeah, I did go, there would have been a reason why his blood could have been there. Cat scratches you, it's nervous, etc. So they said, you know, if you had actually said to us, you did have some contact with her, you did call her, etc., you did make an appointment, you went with that Siamese cat, then we wouldn't have been looking in your direction because it would have been obvious that there was a reason for you to be there. He said, I don't care. I would never have said that because it wasn't true. I never met Kathleen Marshall. I never went to Kathleen Marshall's house.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
House, I was never in her surgery. He just rejected that full stop. Understandably, he appeals. So in 2000, he appealed against his conviction. He argued that he'd been found guilty due to the fraud of the scientist in charge of the case at the laboratory, who was basically responsible for the DNA profiling. He sadly and stupidly refused the help offered by legal aid because a barrister would have needed more time to learn the facts of the case. Just going to say, never refuse the help of legal aid, and certainly never refuse a barrister overseeing it. You need it. So because he doesn't have a barrister aiding him in his appeal, it gets rejected because he had no evidence at all to support his story. It was just his thoughts. He's reacting from a place of anger, frustration, potentially. So he's not thinking clearly and doing what he needs to actually get his best shot at an appeal. Not waiting, not using that legal aid absolutely resulted in what he got, which was a failure in an appeal. Now, if he hadn't let his emotions get to him, which is difficult when you're locked up and he's saying he's innocent, I'm not saying he is, I'm just saying that's what he's saying, there's going to be a desire to get out as quick as possible. But it's foolish to have not gone ahead and gone down the proper legal route, because he didn't realise, and he would have if he'd had a barrister looking over it, he was entitled to retest the blood samples that had been used to convict him for his appeal. But he didn't know it, so it didn't happen. And also, a document which reviewed the DNA evidence was never given to Fitzherbert. And the conclusion of that review was that the claim the bloodstains came from the accused and no one else cannot be justified. Imagine if he'd had that. Imagine seeing that. But he didn't have a barrister. He foolishly passed up the opportunity. And because of that, his appeal was rejected. And that meant he had to serve his sentence. Now, he has always, always maintained that he didn't commit the murder and that he never met Kathleen, as I said, or ever went to the veterinary clinic. Now, in spite of Kathleen's awful death, in March 2002, legacy occurs because the St. Lucia campus of the University of Queensland actually opened up the Kathleen Lambourne building in the Seddon building complex, which is wonderful because Kathleen donated $100,000, which she'd left in her estate. And they were immensely grateful for that donation. And it's incredible. It's a lot of money, probably about 500,000 equivalent today. And they were so thankful for it. Dr. Hughes, the former head of the veterinary school, said her greatest enthusiasm was reserved for her beloved veterinary school, for which she participated in a plethora of fundraising activities. Driving her ideology was a compassionate desire to improve the welfare of animals. She abhorred cruelty in any form. I know that Kathleen, during this story, can come across a little bit bombastic, but I just genuinely like a lot about this woman. She's not too bothered about stuff. She's not too bothered about what people think of her even, but she's absolutely 100% dedicated to animals. And I genuinely think people who are so invested in animals and protect them so deeply, they're good human beings. Sometimes they can be a bit eccentric. I'm a bit eccentric. I love animals. But maybe Kathleen just felt that she had truer and purer relationships with animals because they love you unconditionally. And she felt maybe more let down by human beings. Who knows? Certainly, she wanted to protect the next generation of vets by making sure that they had access to these kind of funds that she left to the organisations that could bring on the next generation. We get to 2008. And a dermatologist who knew Kathleen suggested that, quite left field, I'll say, her death could have actually been caused by a cat. Now, this theory is actually further explained in Ted Durr's book, Crucial Errors in Murder Investigation. So at the time of her death, Kathleen had 16 society cats in her care, as well as her own personal 8 cats. So there was this hypothesis that if Kathleen had picked up a cat and held it up to her left shoulder, a cat that's actually trying to get away from her could have clawed a neck and a shoulder and then turned around and actually ran down her body. And that would have been consistent with where a lot of her injuries were located. Also, a crucial piece of information to potentially support this theory is that Kathleen had Cushing's syndrome. So this is a condition which is a result of someone having too much of the hormone cortisol in their body. And signs of this syndrome include things like weight gain, increased fat around the stomach, we call it the donut effect, also fat around the neck and the chest. You might have a puffy face, stretch marks, and skin, which really bruises easily, and it can cause thinning of the skin as well, which then allows it to be easily torn. Also, it can lead to the weakening of small blood vessels. So that in mind, it could, I suppose, have been that the cat scratches caused her injuries, and then they opened up as her body started to decompose in the warmth of the Brisbane weather, especially considering that the wounds were all very shallow. Now, of course, that's all irrelevant because Fitzherbert is still in prison. He did get released. He got released after 15 years for the murder that he swears he didn't commit. He was reportedly a model inmate whilst he was incarcerated. A lot of people believe he was innocent. A lot of people consider it to have been a massive miscarriage of justice, with the Andrew Fitzherbert Defence Support Group actually lobbying the government to retest the blood samples whilst he was in prison, which I think would have been fair. Why not? If it's only going to confirm what you're saying you know, that he's guilty, fine. But man, if it's going to mean that an innocent man is freed, it's what we should do. But they didn't. His case was also a part of the Griffith University Innocence Project. And let me tell you, the Innocence Project really don't take people on unless they genuinely believe that they're dealing with somebody who has been unfairly convicted. He would still, today, like to have his name cleared. I would love to know your thoughts on this, guys. Do you genuinely think that this is a case of a man who was wrongly tried and convicted? I mean, personally, do I feel he's guilty? Well, I can't say. What I can say is when it comes down to convictions, if there is any reasonable doubt, they shouldn't go to prison. And boy, where this case is concerned, there isn't just reasonable doubt, there is extreme reasonable doubt that this man is guilty. At the end of the day, there were lots of witnesses who saw her alive at a time where he wasn't possibly able to carry out the crime. And yes, his family could have given him an alibi falsely, but the meditation group would never have. I don't know what went wrong in the defense of this man, but I just think that people were so compelled by the idea that DNA is something indisputable that they felt they had no other choice. And maybe that's because it was sold totally inappropriately. In fact, in the UK, that particular type of testing that was used at the time, it was thrown out. It wasn't considered reliable. And yet, I believe it's still used in Australia, which is a little bit worrying. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Hey there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.